I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Violence in this town gets talked about a lot, but one church is looking to take the next step and trying to find a solution. Today, addressing a culture of violence in KC and finding ways to heal it. Not only are people being asked to talk about it, they're being asked to suggest actions to stop it. Then, while Ferguson, Missouri struggles to pay its bills, a Fortune 500 company within its borders rakes in $24 billion a year. Some say this is a recipe for community tension and sacrifices public safety for corporate profits. Later, how the BBC's radio program, The Response, lets listeners broadcast their own stories to the world. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Just yesterday, Kansas City, Missouri Police Chief Daryl Forte tweeted this: "This week I will meet one-on-one with anyone who wants to contribute to reducing crime. Want you to share what you can do. More info to come." Chief Forte may want to stop in at All Souls Unitarian Church this Thursday for the start of its KC Talk series. The very first topic, healing a culture of violence. The plan is to do more than talk about it, and we'll get an explanation for that in just a couple minutes. Here to talk about the culture of violence are two of the panelists that will be at All Souls on Thursday. That's the Reverend Rodney Williams. He's pastor of Swope Parkway United Christian Church. Reverend Williams, so nice to have you.
It's good to be here as well.
Jolie Justice represents Kansas City's 4th District on the City Council. Councilwoman, always nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Also with us is Jane Wilson from All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church and one of the organizers of the KC Talks series. Jane, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
We talk about violence and crime on this program and have for years, but I never thought of it as a culture. Does this city have a culture of violence, Reverend Williams?
I think it does have a culture of violence as well as any other urban city across America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's several things that contribute to that culture.
Such as?
Such as the violence of education. When children are not educated properly, I think that's violence.
Hmm.
Poverty. And then I think that we have weak gun control laws that facilitate violence within our cities.
So this goes a lot farther in your mind than just bullets and guns.
Yes, it's a moral issue that I think has a lot to do with the policies and the laws that we have in the state of Missouri.
Councilwoman Justice, culture of violence in Kansas City, do you buy it?
I think that this country has a culture of violence. It's not limited to Kansas City. If you look across the entire country right now, we see cities of all sizes struggling with very similar issues that we're dealing with. But what we do have is a city right now that is struggling with our children really receiving adverse childhood effects, events, trauma at an unprecedented level, not just in Kansas City, but across the country. And that is breeding what I think, along with, as Reverend Williams suggested, our gun laws and just I think the issue of poverty and education, an overall culture, but it's not just Kansas City, it's nationwide.
You know, it's interesting to me listening to the Reverend Williams, Jolie, because he talks about poverty, he talks about education, he talks about violence on another level. You know, we don't talk a lot in this town about poverty. At least that's been my impression over the years.
We don't talk enough, and frankly, we need to talk a whole lot more about it.
Mm-hmm.
This conversation seems to flare up only when there is an issue that kind of comes to the forefront on the state or the national level, and we need to have an ongoing, nonstop conversation relating to poverty, and it needs to be focusing on all issues, including education, including economic development.
You know, Reverend Williams, you make a point that so many experts also make, and that's this notion that violence, you know, comes from lack of quality education. It comes from the scourge of poverty that so many people in this community suffer from. It's a multifaceted set of solutions, and that makes this problem, you know, so difficult to handle. And arguably, politicians didn't steer away from it because it's costly and it's so complicated to solve.
Well, my response to that is politicians should engage it. And the reason why I believe the politicians should engage it is if we look at the Constitution of the State of Missouri, the Section 2 talks about the welfare of the people. And when government is not taking care of the welfare of the people, it has failed in its chief design. Therefore, there must be a failure somewhere in the legislators' offices because we have these problems. And I think that if we could look at the laws that are being made and passed, and if there was a politics of compassion with the thought of the least of these, mm-hmm. I think that our laws might be different.
Is that part of the problem, Councilwoman Justice, this notion that if you're really going to address violence, you've got to address poverty, and that's expensive and it's complicated, and you have to address education and schools, and that has its own set of issues? This is not simple stuff.
No, I think that's really what makes this one of, if not the most complicated issue that our society is struggling with today, because it's on so many different levels. And the reality is that you can't just throw together some technical fix out of the state legislature or the federal government or city hall and think that it's going to slap a Band-Aid. No, this is an adaptive problem that is going to take community-wide effort, and it's going to have to be nonstop, and it's going to have to be something that is continuing. And Reverend Williams is right. We don't have those conversations at the level we should. And frankly, in Missouri, at least, it's our minority party that is spending the time talking about it, but they don't have the bully pulpit that the majority party has at this point.
Spoken like a true former Democratic leader from the city of Kansas City in the state capital of Missouri.
Absolutely. It was very difficult when you're in Jefferson City every week and you're down there talking about the issues that are most important to Kansas City, but you were in the deep, deep minority. Our legislators that were in the majority party did not feel that their constituents were enduring the same things that our constituents were, which is actually not the truth. Unfortunately, I just don't think they were hearing from their constituents at the same level that we're hearing from ours.
Let me get Jane Wilson into our conversation again. She's with All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church that's putting on this event, talking about healing a culture of violence. Jane, All Souls has held conversations on many topics for a long time. What are those talks called, and how long have they been going on? And give us a sense of the history here.
Sure. All Souls will be celebrating its 150th anniversary next year.
Wow.
And for 75 of those years, we've been holding our forums, which are every Sunday, September through May, at 10 o'clock in the morning at our church. Those forums have been conversations preceded by a presentation by a speaker on some topic of interest to our larger community, usually something somewhat controversial, followed by question and answers from the audience.
So in a sense, you're trying to start the conversation that Councilwoman Justice just alluded to here.
Exactly.
You know, healing a culture of violence is tackling a pretty big issue. Why start with that one?
We were actually asked by Mayor James to hold a community conversation. This is in response to that request. We decided to try a slightly different format than we typically use on Sunday mornings.
And that format's going to be what?
It's going to be a panel discussion with Reverend Williams, Councilwoman Justice, and Dr. Rex Archer from the Kansas City Public Health Department.
Sure.
That will be a moderated discussion, and all of the attendees at this event will be seated around small tables. Each table will have a facilitator and a note taker, and there will be small group discussions. We're going to ask that the discussions include major issues that people bring to the table, as well as coming up with one or two action items. This is probably the biggest difference between our Sunday morning forums. We want some action to come out of this event.
You want solutions.
Exactly. Well, we're not going to come up with a solution in 2 hours on Thursday night, but we will come up with next steps.
You know, Reverend Williams, your church is located at the corner of Swope Parkway and 62nd Street. What do you preach to your congregants about stopping violence in this city? If you were sitting at one of the tables that Jane just referred to, what would you be writing down on your scratch cards there?
One of the things I would be writing down is that it's no longer acceptable to sit back and watch things happen, that you have to connect with a larger movement, because by ourselves we are not strong enough, nor are we clever enough to make a dent into the problem.
I've been hearing that kind of talk in this town for a long time, Reverend.
Yeah. And so, but so it's time that we put our feet to the table and come together as a collective group to find solutions to a problem that is hurting all of us. Now, I know some of our legislators might not think that their constituency is hurt by these issues, but we're all intricately woven together. And so it's a problem for all of us.
To what extent are your congregants eager to come together and talk about some of the solutions, again, that Jane referred to?
I think it's a part of our practice that we have been coming together for the last 3 or 4 years since I've been at the church. And it's a part of who we are to come together and talk with solutions. We participate in Moore Square. We participate in an NAACP. So this is something that has becoming a culture within our church.
Are some of your members going to be at All Souls on Thursday night?
I hope so. And hopefully this would encourage them to come out.
Yeah. Councilman Justice, how is the city council looking to reduce violence these days? What's the agenda for tackling that very tough problem?
So part of the problem that we have with the issue of violence on the city level is, as we talked about, all of the different layers. And so obviously the city is addressing things kind of on an issue-by-issue basis. So let's give an example of last year in the budget. We were able to get an extra $10 million in to work on neighborhood issues. There was a correlation between neighborhoods that had abandoned and vacant properties and not getting those properties cleaned up, and that's where a lot of crime was taking place. And right. So obviously that's one small piece. Many of us outside of the council have a focus on issues of mass incarceration, knowing what that does to our communities. And so working to make sure that we are lobbying in Jefferson City and Washington, D.C. on issues that are more global than just our city relating to mass incarceration. Last year, the mayor put together a citizens' task force on violence, and he asked for pragmatic, common sense recommendations on what we can do to reduce violence in our community. And he didn't put together a group of subject matter experts. He put a group across the board of folks to look at what we're already doing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Reverend Williams just touched on is, and the recommendations are going to be coming out very soon, probably within the next couple of weeks, is that we have a lot of people doing a lot of good things out there right now, and we need to coordinate better, and we need to work together to make sure that everyone is working towards the same goal. We can have different methods, we can have different philosophies, but we all need to work together towards this goal. And so that's one of the things that the council is going to focus on, is do we have some resources, whether they be brick and mortar resources or financial resources for staffing or that sort of thing to help with the coordination piece.
Yeah.
But a lot of this has to come from within the community, and we understand that. And so what can we do to aid the community's efforts?
It just seems to me the solutions, again, are so difficult here. Take something as basic as the need for more police officers. Some folks advocate that. Other folks say, you know, we've got enough. I've heard Chief Forte say we've got enough officers in this town right now. And so as a someone like yourself who sits in the city council, Councilman Justice, you're looking at, you know, problems, trying to find solutions. And what's the answer here? Is it more police officers or is it fewer? Nothing's easy.
No, it's not easy. And I'm not sure that that's a question that's easily answered. I mean, the reality is I know that Chief Forte in the police department right now is taking a look at a staffing survey to find out if they have enough police and if they have them in the right places. So that's mm-hmm. incredibly important. But more police officers, more law enforcement isn't the answer to these problems. These problems are much bigger than that. I think one of the things the mayor wanted us to look at is there anything we can do at a local level relating to firearms? Last year, there were 127 homicides in Kansas City, and 116 of those involved firearms. So if you want to say this is not about guns, well, you can't say it's not about guns. Mm-hmm. This is about firearms. But the state of Missouri has made it very clear through their constitution and through their statutes that we cannot pass any laws locally. They are all 100% preempted. So how do we continue to work within the city to make sure that we have guns out of the hands of people who are using them illegally?
Mm-hmm.
That's something that we need to talk about. Some of the violence that we've seen rise in Kansas City has to do with domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
You could put 1,000 more police officers on the street and it would not impact the piece of domestic violence, of violence in the home. No number of patrol cars circulating is going to help with that. So we need to work with our domestic violence advocacy groups to make sure that we have all of the services in place that are going to assist with that as well. It's very complicated and it's going to take a long time, but I think you know, the other option we have is to quit, and none of us are willing to do that.
I was going to say, sometimes, Reverend Williams, you just want to shake your head. Even listening to Councilwoman Justice outline these different solutions, different answers, nothing simple here, as I keep saying.
No, you're right. There's nothing simple. But there's a question I would like to raise.
Yeah.
And that is, how many more mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters have to experience the loss of a loved one? How many more gallons of blood need to be spilled on the concrete streets of this city? Last year, 127. In my mind, as long as we have the laws that we have that are on the books that allows this to happen, I think that the legislators in Jefferson City should be convicted of at least co-conspiracy of murder.
That's a pretty strong statement.
Their lack of actions, I think, is even stronger.
And they would argue that they have taken actions, that they've done certain things, and you're saying you're not buying it.
Maybe they have taken actions, but I don't think their actions are moral actions. I believe that the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Missouri have to be constitutionally strong and correct, but I think that they are grounded in a moral fiber that knits this nation together, and I don't think that's happening right now, especially with our gun laws.
Do you see yourself taking steps to indict lawmakers on what you're talking about here? Is that something you want to engage in?
I'm not sure.
But it's crossed your mind.
It definitely has crossed my mind. If it hadn't crossed my mind, I would not have said it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely has crossed my mind because someone has to take responsibility for what is happening, and I believe that our legislators have the power and the wherewithal to make a big change in our city and across the state.
Again, Councilman Justice, you served as a state senator down there. An action like the one Reverend Williams just suggested would get a lot of attention in Jefferson City.
It sure would, and we need to back up for a minute and also point out that our current legislature, they have not taken steps forward to help protect our communities. They've only taken steps back. One of the only things we had going for us in the state of Missouri was that you could not get a concealed carry permit if you had been convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence or you had a current restraining order against you for domestic violence. When they removed the need for a permit for concealed carry weapons last year, they took the one final protection away that we had for victims of domestic violence. These are the types of things where every year they set us back a little bit more and a little bit more. What we can do is continue to go to Jefferson City. I think it's probably time to remind everybody that right now our police board is appointed by our governor, Eric Greitens, who has made it clear that he wants to keep it in his camp. If that's the case, then we need to be going to Jefferson City and standing outside of his office and saying, what are you going to do about violence in our community? Mm-hmm. You're in charge of the police in Kansas City. What's going on?
Well, part of this is a political problem, though, isn't it, Councilwoman Justice? This notion that Republican lawmakers who rule the roost in Jeff City largely come from rural areas or suburban areas, and they're not dealing with some of the same issues that the two of you are outlining here this morning.
That's absolutely true, and we have to make sure that we also discuss the absolute control that the NRA lobby has of our legislators in Jefferson City. I just received words a couple of minutes ago that the NRA lobby is now starting to lobby against the Real ID Act in the state of Missouri, which of course is this idea that we're not going to be able to get on airplanes to fly to St. Louis without a passport coming in January 2018. And that just shifts the whole conversation immediately. They have a complete stranglehold on our legislature, and we need to come up with an alternative to them.
You know, Jane Wilson from All Souls, what are you going to do? You had this list of policy ideas, of solutions that will come out of the meeting on Thursday. What happens with that list at that point?
Our note takers will be capturing all of those ideas and the suggested action items. We'll compile all of those notes. We will be posting that on our website, allsoulskc.org. And from that, depending on what comes out of it, we will be planning the next event. Could be study groups about particular issues that have arisen, maybe communication campaigns with our elected officials. Who knows what will come out of it, but those will be announced on our website and through Facebook.
I'm wondering if Chief Daryl Forte will be at the meeting on Thursday, if you have any confirmation of that.
I don't. I certainly hope so. We have reached out to a lot of the organizations that are already working on the issue of violence in our metropolitan area, and we obviously are not the only group working on this, but we truly want to work with everyone else who is working on it.
I should point out that KC Talks will be this Thursday from 6:30 to 8:30 at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut. That's right across the street from Kemper Museum, just in case folks want to connect there. Reverend Williams, how often do you talk about this issue from the pulpit in your church? To what extent does violence in our town dominate your message coming from the pulpit each week?
Quite a bit.
Really?
Yes, and the reason why is because I don't see how the gospel of Jesus Christ can be preached without dealing with the social implications that are going on in the city and town in which you're living.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, basically what we do does have a direct, is impacted by the city in which we live. For example, I ask a question, how is it that it is easier for a person to purchase a gun than it is for some people to become registered voters?
Hmm. And the answer you get back is what?
There is no legitimate answer.
Yeah. Julie, you're nodding your head as you hear the Reverend say that.
He's absolutely right. It's easier to get a gun than it is to register to vote. And that is fundamentally what we're up against.
Hmm. And what else do you hear back from your how do you avoid discouragement over an issue like this, again, that's been talked about in this town for so many years?
I think you just have to keep your shoulders to the grindstone and keep working and keep pushing and understand that no matter how dark it is, there is going to be some light at the end of the tunnel. Scriptures teaches us that we are people of faith and that we should not draw back into destruction. So we have to keep pressing forward.
Okay, this event again, Thursday evening, 6:30 to 8:30 at All Souls. Everybody's invited, right, Jane?
It's open to the public.
Okay.
Everyone is welcome.
The Reverend Rodney Williams, pastor of Swope Parkway United Christian Church, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Councilwoman Jolie Justice represents Kansas City's 4th District. Appreciate it always, Jolie.
Thanks, Steve.
Jane Wilson with All Souls, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Ferguson's Fortune 500 company that may not be paying the same tax load as other comparable to other folks in town. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. On Friday, we heard about 5 sci-fi movie moments that actually came true, and we spoke with prolific writer Charles Johnson about his creative process. You can listen to those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we speak with Chef Lydia Bastianich, who's hosting a Carnival of Venice celebration here in Kansas City. That's tomorrow here on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, not far from where Michael Brown was fatally shot by a Ferguson police officer back in 2014 sits Emerson Electric. That's a Fortune 500 company doing $24 billion a year in business. That proximity raises an important question, says our next guest. Why is it that such a large corporation can get by paying so little in taxes while its money-challenged hometown is forced to levy tens of thousands of dollars in fees each year in fines from its poor residents? That's led to tensions in Ferguson that erupted when Michael Brown was shot to death. Our guest is Walter Johnson. He's director of the Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History at Harvard. He's a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, and he's written about this issue in The Atlantic. He'll be in town this week. And Walter, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You say that the shots that Officer Darren Wilson fired at Michael Brown could probably have been heard in the Emerson Electric lunchroom. And you point out that the city of Ferguson has an office park filled with corporate tenants. That suggests a cash-rich municipality. Instead, though, Ferguson, quote, relies on its cops and its courts to extract millions in fines and fees from its poorest residents, issuing thousands of citations each year. That's what you wrote in The Atlantic. I'm wondering why. How can that possibly be, Walter?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing to emphasize is that fines in 2013 accounted for 20% of the municipal budget of the city of Ferguson.
Right.
That was $2.6 million in fines. And so it does seem alarming that there's a $24 billion of Fortune 500 company within the municipal limits of Ferguson. There are various ways that one might explain that. I began with Emerson Electric and started to work my way backwards, really, through the history of 20th century St. Louis. So the most proximate answer is in the systematic underassessment of real estate wealth in St. Louis County and in, I think, the state of Missouri generally, and that has to do partly with state law limits that are put on municipalities that that make it difficult for municipalities to raise taxes. All municipal government in the state of Missouri operates under what's called the Hancock
Amendment. The Hancock Amendment. It's been an issue in our state for many, many years. Yeah.
Right. And so what the Hancock Amendment says is that it pegs all revenue to 1980 levels and says that any city that wants to raise any sort of taxes above and beyond that needs to do so by referendum, which is a more difficult, it's difficult to get people to vote to tax themselves.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, wouldn't Ferguson residents approve an increase in taxes despite the Hancock Amendment if they knew that would lessen the dependence on police fines in their community?
I mean, it's a complicated question. I think you probably have to ask which residents and who's going to be paying the taxes. I think that certainly this was happening, this sort of revenue farming through fines was happening and is still happening all over St. Louis County. It is something that various political groups and legal groups have known about and been trying to combat for a long time. The fact is that any efforts to raise taxes through the legally stipulated means have not been as successful as cities have been in simply going around the problem of raising revenue that way. And so what cities have done, municipalities have done, particularly in St. Louis County, is raise money through fines and fees, and they, in the article, I say that the difficulty that cities have in rather than being able to raise money through taxes, what cities can do is to try to foster economic development mm-hmm. through basically giving money away through different sorts of tax breaks that they provide to corporations.
Yeah, we'll talk about that here in a little bit. I'm wondering, how unusual is Ferguson? I mean, given the fact that the Justice Department just concluded that Ferguson's law enforcement practices are shaped by the city's focus on revenue rather than public safety needs, are there lots of Fergusons across the state of Missouri, Professor?
I try to make a distinction between the systematic racism and race-based practice within the Ferguson Police Department, which I think was extreme, although certainly not unique, and the structural economic conditions which framed that behavior. And I think that the structural economic conditions under the Hancock Amendment are pervasive. Cities in Missouri, like cities across the United States of America, have a very, very difficult time raising revenue.
So that would suggest that there are lots of cities out there that are police departments issuing fees and tickets, fines and tickets, just to boost the coffers of their local municipalities.
I do believe that in many cities in the United States of America, and this is not just Missouri and it's not just St. Louis, the distinction between public safety and revenue production has disappeared. And I further believe that leads to revenue, the revenue fines fall largely on poor people. It's poor people who have busted taillights, mm-hmm. right? It's poor people who have lawns that are not properly maintained, which was another category of fine that was levied in Ferguson and in some of these other municipalities. And it's poor people who are housing insecure. And so when they get a warrant when they get a warning for a court appearance, are not in the same address that they were in when they got the initial ticket. Mm-hmm. And so it's poor people who don't make court appearances because they're housing insecure, they didn't get notification, and then they get a warrant for their arrest, which is what was happening in Ferguson, where there were, something like 12,000 outstanding arrest warrants issued by this tiny little municipality at the time that Michael Brown got shot in 2014.
Well, let's go back to Emerson Electric. I'm wondering how much in taxes were they paying, at least at the time of the article that you wrote, and what did they say about this idea that maybe they're not paying enough, given their relative wealth sitting in a community like Ferguson, Missouri?
So the research I did, as best I could tell, on the 152-acre, seven-building complex that Emerson has in Ferguson, was assessed at about $15 million, and the assessment would go up or down from year to year, but it was around about that level. And when one sorted out all of the ways that the property is, you know, there's a low, that's an extremely low assessment by my evaluation. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a property in 2009 where Emerson proudly announced a ribbon cutting ceremony on the construction of a $50 million data center.
Yes, right.
Jane Nixon was present, and so the question is how does a property that has seven buildings and is 152 acres, including a $50 million data center, get assessed at $15 million?
And what did you hear about that, Professor?
I'm sorry?
What did you hear in response to that question?
Well, so Emerson's answer, I initially thought that this must be part of a real estate tax abatement that exists all over the state of Missouri,
sure,
called the Chapter 353 tax abatement, which is that anybody who could who builds something in a community or in a zone that is designated as economically blighted is eligible to receive a Chapter 353 tax abatement. And what that does is it means that there's no taxes, real estate taxes, on that property for 10 years, and then for the next 15 years, it is assessed at 50%. It's taxed at 50% of its assessed value.
But Emerson says that wasn't the case, though, right?
Emerson said that was not the case, and so their response was simply, and this was extraordinary to me, really. Their response was, we know that we are eligible for these various tax abatements.
We didn't take them.
Chapter 353 or Chapter 100, but we didn't take them, and we didn't take them because we're happy with our property assessment. We think it's fair. And that property value assessment, the real and improved property, the real estate plus the improvements, basically ended up giving the city of Ferguson somewhere around $60,000 a year. And so, you know, one of the things I say in the story is that this is a police department that bought, you know, some like 15, 16 brand new Chevrolet Tahoes in the year that Darren Wilson shot Michael Brown. So Emerson paid for one of those Chevy Tahoes, or Emerson paid the salary of the municipal judge who was handing out this $2.6 million in fines. So it's to my way of thinking, it is a scandalously low contribution to the city where Emerson has its and has had for many years its corporate headquarters. They've been in Ferguson for 70 years, I think.
So at the root of this issue, it sounds like you're pointing to the Hancock Amendment. You're pointing to the property tax assessment, which is, in your view, way undervalued for the 152-acre, seven-building site assessed at around $15 million. That's a double whammy that you're saying that Ferguson simply can't get past when it comes to generating more revenue.
That's right. And, you know, it's, I mean, and so they have then responded by doing what a lot of cities do, which is trying to build revenue by providing incentives to other corporations. And so in the northern part of Ferguson, up West Larson Avenue from where Michael Brown was shot, there's a sort of a industrial park that has a Walmart and it has a Home Depot, and this is a development that has been subsidized by the city of Ferguson through tax increment financing. And what tax increment financing means is that a city will actually take out bonds, will sell bonds, and so the city becomes a creditor of bondholders. And the money that the city is borrowing from the bondholders will be used to do infrastructural industrial development. So basically to reduce the costs to a Walmart or to a Home Depot to move to that city. And the speculation involved is that the increased revenue generated by the Walmart or the Home Depot or whatever will be great enough to cover the city's bond obligation. In the case of the TIF development in what's called the Halls Ferry TIF in the northern part of Ferguson, that didn't prove the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so in addition to not actually getting very much in the way of real estate taxes from this Fortune 500 company at one end of West Forest Avenue, the city ended up subsidizing through general revenue and really through fines and fees the economic development at the other end of West Forest Avenue.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date this morning, and we're visiting with Walter Johnson, who's a professor at Harvard. He's written in Atlantic Magazine about this juxtaposition in Ferguson, Missouri, a city that was notorious for handing out all kinds of traffic tickets, minor traffic tickets, lots of fines to its poorer citizens. At the same time, a $24 billion a year business sits in that community, Emerson Electric, raising questions about whether Emerson pays its fair share or not. Professor, is Ferguson still doing this, ticketing its residents at the same rate as before? Because I think I've read that the answer to that is no.
I think the answer is no. I think that they're under a federal injunction from the Justice Department to reduce the proportion of their municipal budget that is raised through fines. Now, there's a couple of things to say about that. First, the first thing to say about those fines is that 86% of the traffic stops that occurred in Ferguson were stops of black motorists, and so there was a way that this particular political economic problem, which I would say has to do partly with the history of race and real estate over the long term in St. Louis, over the long 20th century, was being expressed in racialized policing. And then the second thing to say is that Ferguson is one of 92 municipalities in St. Louis County, many of which were raising money through the same sort of predatory policing that was operative in Ferguson, and many of those municipalities are not under the same sort of legal surveillance that has obtained in Ferguson since the Department of Justice report. So I think that Ferguson was at least up until the rollover in the Justice Department under a microscope, and that is not a microscope that is applied to all the municipalities in St. Louis County or Missouri generally or the United States.
Yeah.
More generally than that.
Walter, you point out in the story that Emerson has tried to be a good neighbor. You point out that in 2014, the company announced a program of support for early childhood education, jobs for young people, college scholarships for students from surrounding high schools to study engineering at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. So they've taken some steps. Is that adequate in your view?
I think I would want to have a two-sided answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
As I looked more into this, it became clear to me that one could make an argument, and certainly the people at Emerson with whom I spoke did make an argument, that Emerson is actually a model in terms of what they call corporate citizenship, in terms of corporate philanthropy. Now, that then for me, called into question that entire model of civic engagement, the entire notion of corporate philanthropy as a mechanism of economic and social development.
Because you say at the bottom line that the corporation could dig deeper into the causes of some of the systemic racism that's been so prevalent in Ferguson.
Absolutely, and to put the choice of how to allocate money, first of all, into the hands of elected representatives rather than in the hands of corporations.
Yeah.
And secondly, I try to identify what I think of as a focus on what I would call, a relationship between notions of exceptionality and notions of disposability.
Well, so I'm going to have to wrap. I'm just simply running out of time here, but I want to point out that our listeners can see and hear Walter Johnson 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. To grab a seat, you can go to kclibrary.org. His article, again, was in the Atlantic magazine back in 2015. Walter, thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
For any of you who are late night or early morning listeners to KCUR, you're familiar with the BBC World Service. Well, in a partnership with American Public Media, the BBC has a new project called The Response, America's Story, and it gives you a chance to join in. With us now from the studios of the BBC to tell us more about it is the program's producer, that's Kevin Corin. Kevin, nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Nice to talk to you.
What's the basic premise for this, Kevin, and how do listeners participate?
Well, The Response America's Story is all about hearing firsthand from the people. Now, a lot of us have access to smartphones, and the voice recorders on them, they've really developed and they're really easy to use. So the way it works is we put a topic of conversation out there, and anyone with a smartphone can find that voice recorder and record us a story about their lives. So they email that sound file to us, we edit it all together, so anyone listening now could have their stories broadcast not just across America, but to hundreds of millions on the BBC World Service.
Well, what's the question you're asking this time around, Kevin?
Well, we thought it'd be interesting to hear people's stories about health because it's a huge topic here and in America. You could be in great health, and if so, tell us how you make the most of it. You might have turned your lifestyle around. And if you're not in good health, how have you faced it? What has it taught you? You could even be a medical professional who can talk about what compelled you to want to make people well. Maybe working in health was inspired just by one incident. So it's a chance for people to let their imaginations run wild, and we'll give you the email to let you take part in a moment.
You know, you've been getting responses already. Joyce Den is a retired nurse who worked in a maternity ward. She's from Woodbury, Minnesota, and she sent in a voice recording to explain her situation. She calls it complete health denial. Let's take a listen to some of what she had to say.
One of the reasons I needed to retire was because I do have a long list of health problems. I have heart disease, I have a pacemaker, I have a history of atrial fibrillation, idiopathic peripheral neuropathy, which makes it hard for me to walk a lot. But I feel fine. I cannot think of myself as being in ill health. And when I have to fill in questionnaires where I'm asked to rate my health, I really have a hard time putting down anything that is not excellent, or at the very least, very good. Whatever it is, I'm a nurse. I should know that I'm not in the best of health, but I don't.
And that's a little sense of the kind of response you're looking for, right?
Yeah, it was Joyce Den somehow feeling grace despite that list of ailments there. And we know that not everyone is so lucky. So we'd like to hear all those unusual incidents and perspectives about health that are out there.
So again, the process for getting you some of these little mini stories here, Kevin, is what? What do people need to do?
All they have to do is take a look at their smartphone, and on there, often now, there is a voice recorder. So you can hear from Joyce just then that the quality is really high, and it's important, we think, to sound natural. So don't worry about writing anything down or making it perfect. Just tell your story naturally, pauses and all, like you would in a conversation. So then you save that sound file and email it to us at theresponse@bbc.co.uk. That's theresponse@bbc.co.uk.
You know, we'll post a link to The Response on our webpage as well. This is only the second installment of the program. I got to ask, how did the first one go?
It was incredibly interesting. It's obviously a time of huge change in America, and the program's a bit of an experiment in a new way of storytelling for a new time. So last time we heard life stories from a spacecraft engineer, from school teachers, from coal miners, and we think there are some fantastic health stories out there. So all people have to do is grab their phones, find that voice recorder, and that email is theresponse@bbc.co.uk.
That's Kevin Corr. He's a producer of The Response, America's Story. He joined us from the studios of the BBC. So get your smartphone out and record your health experience, then send it off. Kevin, good luck with the program. Appreciate the time.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow we catch up with Chef Lydia Bastianich and learn about the Carnival of Venice celebration she's hosting right here in Kansas City, which is so similar to Venice in so many ways. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.